The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway. This book consists of 19 chapters and is 247 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. When The Sun Also Rises appeared in 1926, it immediately established Ernest Hemingway as the preeminent writer of his generation. The poignantly beautiful story of a group of American and English expatriates on a sojourn from Paris to Pamplona, it represents a dramatic step forward from Hemingway's narrative achievement in Our Time. Hemingway is at the peak of his artistic powers in his vivid depiction of the left bank of Paris during the 20s and in his brutally realistic description of bullfighting in Spain. His understanding of character also reveals a profound new maturity. The flamboyant Lady Brett Ashley and the hapless Jake Barnes emerge from their hopelessly romantic relationship as representatives of an age of moral bankruptcy and spiritual dissolution, of unrealized love and vanishing illusions, the lost generation of which Gertrude Stein spoke. Hemingway's second novel, and in his opinion the most successful, The Sun Also Rises confirmed the belief that he would be the big man in American letters, as Alan Tate wrote at the time. It now stands as one of the classics of modernist fiction. Dedication. This book is for Hadley and for John Hadley Nicanor. You are all a lost generation. Gertrude Stein in Conversation. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to the place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Ecclesiastes. Book 1. Chapter 1. Robert Cohn was once middleweight boxing champion of Princeton. Do not think that I am very much impressed by that as a boxing title, but it meant a lot to Cohn. He cared nothing for boxing. In fact, he disliked it. But he learned it painfully and thoroughly to counteract the feeling of inferiority and shyness he had felt on being treated as a Jew at Princeton. There was a certain inner comfort in knowing he could knock down anybody who was snooty to him, although, being very shy and a thoroughly nice boy, he never fought except in the gym. He was Spider Kelly's star pupil. Spider Kelly taught all his young gentlemen to box like featherweights, no matter whether they weighed 105 or 205 pounds. But it seemed to fit Cohn. He was really very fast. He was so good that Spider promptly overmatched him and got his nose permanently flattened. This increased Cohn's distaste for boxing, but it gave him a certain satisfaction of some strange sort, and it certainly improved his nose. In his last year at Princeton, he read too much and took to wearing spectacles. I never met anyone of his class who remembered him. They do not even remember that he was middleweight boxing champion. I mistrust all frank and simple people, especially when their stories hold together, and I always had a suspicion that perhaps Robert Cohn had never been middleweight boxing champion, and that perhaps a horse had stepped on his face, or that maybe his mother had been frightened or seen something, or that he had maybe bumped into something as a young child. But I finally had somebody verify the story from Spider Kelly. Spider Kelly not only remembered Cohn, he had often wondered what had become of him. Robert Cohn was a member through his father of one of the richest Jewish families in New York, and through his mother of one of the oldest. At the military school where he prepped for Princeton and played a very good end on the football team, no one had made him race-conscious. No one had ever made him feel he was a Jew, and hence any different from anybody else, until he went to Princeton. He was a nice boy, a friendly boy, and very shy, and it made him bitter. He took it out in boxing, and he came out of Princeton with painful self-consciousness and a flattened nose, and was married by the first girl who was nice to him. He was married 5 years, had 3 children, lost most of the $50,000 his father left him, the balance of the estate having gone to his mother, hardened into a rather unattractive mold under domestic unhappiness with a rich wife. And just when he had made up his mind to leave his wife, she left him and went off with a miniature painter. as he had been thinking for months about leaving his wife and had not done it because it would be too cruel to deprive her of himself, her departure was a very helpful shock. The divorce was arranged, and Robert Cohn went out to the coast. In California, he fell among literary people, and, as he still had a little of the $50,000 left, in a short time he was backing a review of the arts. The review commenced publication in Carmel, California, and finished in Provincetown, Massachusetts. By that time, Cohn, who had been regarded purely as an angel, and whose name had appeared on the editorial page merely as a member of the advisory board, had become the sole editor. It was his money, and he discovered he liked the authority of editing. He was sorry when the magazine became too expensive, and he had to give it up. By that time, though, he had other things to worry about. He had been taken in hand by a lady who hoped to rise with the magazine. She was very forceful, and Cohn never had a chance of not being taken in hand. Also, he was sure that he loved her. When this lady saw that the magazine was not going to rise, she became a little disgusted with Cohn and decided that she might as well get what there was to get while there was still something available, so she urged that they go to Europe, where Cohn could write. They came to Europe, where the lady had been educated, and stayed 3 years. During these 3 years, the first spent in travel, the last two in Paris, Robert Cohn had two friends, Braddix and myself. Braddix was his literary friend. I was his tennis friend. The lady who had him, her name was Frances, found toward the end of the second year that her looks were going, and her attitude toward Robert changed from one of careless possession and exploitation to the absolute determination that he should marry her. During this time, Robert's mother had settled an allowance on him, about $300 a month. During 2 years and a half, I do not believe that Robert Cohn looked at another woman. He was fairly happy, except that, like many people living in Europe, he would rather have been in America, and he had discovered writing. He wrote a novel, and it was not really such a bad novel as the critics later called it, although it was a very poor novel. He read many books, played bridge, played tennis, and boxed at a local gymnasium. I first became aware of his lady's attitude toward him one night after the three of us had dined together. We had dined at L'Avenue's, and afterward went to the Café de Versailles for coffee. We had several fines after the coffee, and I said I must be going. Cohn had been talking about the two of us going off somewhere on a weekend trip. He wanted to get out of town and get in a good walk. I suggested we fly to Strasbourg and walk up to Saint-Odile or somewhere or other in Alsace. "I know a girl in Strasbourg who can show us the town," I said. Somebody kicked me under the table. I thought it was accidental and went on, "She's been there 2 years and knows everything there is to know about the town. She's a swell girl." I was kicked again under the table, and looking, saw Frances, Robert's lady, her chin lifting and her face hardening. "Hell," I said, "why go to Strasbourg? We could go up to Bruges or to the Ardennes." Cohn looked relieved. I was not kicked again. I said good night and went out. Cohn said he wanted to buy a paper and would walk to the corner with me. "For God's sake," he said, "why did you say that about that girl in Strasbourg for? Didn't you see Frances?" "No, why should I? If I know an American girl that lives in Strasbourg, what the hell is it to Frances?" "It doesn't make any difference, any girl. I couldn't go, that would be all." "Don't be silly. You don't know Frances. Any girl at all. Didn't you see the way she looked?" "Oh, well," I said, "let's go to Senlis." "Don't get sore." "I'm not sore. Senlis is a good place, and we can stay at the Grand Cerf and take a hike in the woods and come home." "Good, that will be fine." "Well, I'll see you tomorrow at the courts," I said. "Good night, Jake," he said, and started back to the cafe. "You forgot to get your paper," I said. "That's so." He walked with me up to the kiosk at the corner. "You're not sore, are you, Jake?" He turned with the paper in his hand. "No, why should I be?" "See you at tennis," he said. I watched him walk back to the cafe holding his paper. I rather liked him, and evidently she led him quite a life. Chapter 2. That winter, Robert Cohn went over to America with his novel, and it was accepted by a fairly good publisher. His going made an awful row, I heard, and I think that was where Frances lost him, because several women were nice to him in New York, and when he came back he was quite changed. He was more enthusiastic about America than ever, and he was not so simple. and he was not so nice. The publishers had praised his novel pretty highly, and it rather went to his head. Then several women had put themselves out to be nice to him, and his horizons had all shifted. For 4 years, his horizon had been absolutely limited to his wife. For 3 years, or almost 3 years, he had never seen beyond Frances. I'm sure he had never been in love in his life. He had married on the rebound from the rotten time he had in college, and Frances took him on the rebound from his discovery that he had not been everything to his first wife. He was not in love yet, but he realized that he was an attractive quantity to women, and that the fact of a woman caring for him and wanting to live with him was not simply a divine miracle. This changed him so that he was not so pleasant to have around. Also, playing for higher stakes than he could afford in some rather steep bridge games with his New York connections, he had held cards and won several hundred dollars. It made him rather vain of his bridge game, and he talked several times of how a man could always make a living at bridge if he were ever forced to. Then there was another thing. He'd been reading W. H. Hudson. Well, that sounds like an innocent occupation, but Cohn had read and reread The Purple Land. The Purple Land is a very sinister book if read too late in life. It recounts splendid imaginary amorous adventures of a perfect English gentleman in an intensely romantic land, the scenery of which is very well described. For a man to take it at 34 as a guidebook to what life holds is about as safe as it would be for a man of the same age to enter Wall Street direct from a French convent, equipped with a complete set of the more practical Alger books. Cohn, I believe, took every word of The Purple Land as literally as though it had been an R.G. Dunn report. You understand me, he made some reservations, but on the whole, the book to him was sound. It was all that was needed to set him off. I did not realize the extent to which it had set him off until one day he came into my office. "Hello, Robert," I said. "Did you come in to cheer me up?" "Would you like to go to South America, Jake?" he asked. "No." "Why not?" "I don't know. I never wanted to go. Too expensive. You can see all the South Americans you want in Paris anyway." "They're not the real South Americans." "They look awfully real to me." I had a boat train to catch with a week's mail stories and only half of them written. "Do you know any dirt?" I asked. "No." "None of your exalted connections getting divorces?" "No. Listen, Jake, if I handled both our expenses, would you go to South America with me?" "Why me?" "You can talk Spanish, and it would be more fun with two of us." "No," I said. "I like this town, and I go to Spain in the summertime." "All my life I've wanted to go on a trip like that," Cohn said. He sat down. "I'll be too old before I can ever do it." "Don't be a fool," I said. "You can go anywhere you want. You've got plenty of money." "I know, but I can't get started." "Cheer up," I said. "All countries look just like the moving pictures." But I felt sorry for him. He had it badly. "I can't stand it to think my life is going so fast, and I'm not really living it." "Nobody ever lives their life all the way up except bullfighters." "I'm not interested in bullfighters. That's an abnormal life. I want to go back in the country in South America. We could have a great trip." "Did you ever think about going to British East Africa to shoot?" "No, I wouldn't like that." "I'd go there with you." "No, that doesn't interest me." "That's because you never read a book about it. Go on and read a book all full of love affairs with the beautiful, shiny black princesses." "I want to go to South America." He had a hard, Jewish, stubborn streak. "Come on downstairs and have a drink." "Aren't you working?" "No," I said. We went down the stairs to the cafe on the ground floor. I had discovered that was the best way to get rid of friends. Once you had a drink, all you had to say was, "Well, I've got to get back and get off some cables," and it was done. It is very important to discover graceful exits like that in the newspaper business, where it is such an important part of the ethics that you should never seem to be working. Anyway, we went downstairs to the bar and had a whiskey and soda. Cohn looked at the bottles and bins around the wall. "This is a good place," he said. "There's a lot of liquor," I agreed. "Listen, Jake," he leaned forward on the bar. "Don't you ever get the feeling that all your life is going by and you're not taking advantage of it? Do you realize you've lived nearly half the time you have to live already?" "Yes, every once in a while." "Do you know that in about 35 years more we'll be dead?" "What the hell, Robert?" I said. "What the hell?" "I'm serious." It's one thing I don't worry about, I said. You ought to. I've had plenty to worry about one time or other. I'm through worrying. Well, I want to go to South America. Listen, Robert, going to another country doesn't make any difference. I've tried all that. You can't get away from yourself by moving from one place to another. There's nothing to that. But you've never been to South America. South America, hell. If you went there the way you feel now, it would be exactly the same. This is a good town. Why don't you start living your life in Paris? I'm sick of Paris, and I'm sick of the Quarter. Stay away from the Quarter. Cruise around by yourself and see what happens to you. Nothing happens to me. I walked alone all one night, nothing happened except a bicycle cop stopped me and asked to see my papers. Wasn't the town nice at night? I don't care for Paris. So there you were. I was sorry for him, but it was not a thing you could do anything about. Because right away you ran up against the two stubbornnesses. South America could fix it, and he did not like Paris. He got the first idea out of a book, and I suppose the second came out of a book, too. Well, I said, I've got to go upstairs and get off some cables. Do you really have to go? Yes, I've got to get these cables off. Do you mind if I come up and sit around the office? No, come on up. He sat in the outer room and read the papers, and the editor and publisher and I worked hard for 2 hours. Then I sorted out the carbons, stamped on a byline, put the stuff in a couple of big manila envelopes, and rang for a boy to take them to the Gare Saint-Lazare. I went out into the other room, and there was Robert Cohn asleep in the big chair. He was asleep with his head on his arms. I did not like to wake him up, but I wanted to lock the office and shove off. I put my hand on his shoulder. He shook his head. I can't do it, he said, and put his head deeper into his arms. I can't do it. Nothing will make me do it. Robert, I said, and shook him by the shoulder. He looked up. He smiled and blinked. Did I talk out loud just then? Something, but it wasn't clear. God, what a rotten dream. Did the typewriter put you to sleep? Guess so. I didn't sleep all last night. What was the matter? Talking, he said. I could picture it. I have a rotten habit of picturing the bedroom scenes of my friends. We went out to the Café Napolitain to have an apéritif and watch the evening crowd on the boulevard. Chapter 3. It was a warm spring night, and I sat at a table on the terrace of the Napolitain after Robert had gone, watching it get dark and the electric signs come on, and the red and green stop-and-go traffic signal, and the crowd going by, and the horse cabs clippity-clopping along at the edge of the solid taxi traffic, and the pool going by, singly and in pairs, looking for the evening meal. I watched a good-looking girl walk past the table, and watched her go up the street and lost sight of her, and watched another, and then saw the first one coming back again. She went by once more, and I caught her eye, and she came over and sat down at the table. The waiter came up. Well, what will you drink? I asked. Perno. That's not good for little girls. Little girl yourself. Dit garçon, un perno. A perno for me, too. What's the matter? She asked. Going on a party? Sure, aren't you? I don't know. You never know in this town. Don't you like Paris? No. Why don't you go somewhere else? Isn't anywhere else. You're happy, all right. Happy hell. Perno is greenish imitation absinthe. When you add water, it turns milky. It tastes like licorice, and it has a good uplift, but it drops you just as far. We sat and drank it, and the girl looked sullen. Well, I said, are you going to buy me a dinner? She grinned, and I saw why she made a point of not laughing. With her mouth closed, she was a rather pretty girl. I paid for the saucers, and we walked out to the street. I hailed a horse cab, and the driver pulled up at the curb. Settled back in the slow, smoothly rolling fiacre, we moved up the Avenue de l'Opéra, past the locked doors of the shops, their windows lighted, the avenue broad and shiny and almost deserted. The cab passed the New York Herald Bureau with the window full of clocks. "What are all the clocks for?" she asked. "They show the hour all over America." "Don't kid me." We turned off the avenue up the Rue des Pyramides, through the traffic of the Rue de Rivoli, and through a dark gate into the Tuileries. She cuddled against me, and I put my arm around her. She looked up to be kissed. She touched me with one hand, and I put her hand away. "Never mind."
"What's the matter? You sick?"
"Yes. Everybody's sick. I'm sick, too." We came out of the Tuileries into the light and crossed the Seine, and then turned up the Rue des Saint-Pères.
"You oughtn't to drink Pernod if you're sick."
"You neither."
"It doesn't make any difference with me. It doesn't make any difference with a woman."
"What are you called?"
"Georgette. How are you called?"
"Jacob."
"That's a Flemish name."
"American, too."
"You're not Flamand?"
"No, American."
"Good, I detest Flamands."
By this time we were at the restaurant. I called to the cocher to stop. We got out and Georgette did not like the looks of the place.
"This is no great thing of a restaurant."
"No," I said. "Maybe you'd rather go to Foyot's. Why don't you keep the cab and go on?" I had picked her up because of a vague sentimental idea that it would be nice to eat with someone. It was a long time since I had dined with a pool, and I'd forgotten how dull it could be. We went into the restaurant, passed Madame Lavigne at the desk, and came into a little room. Georgette cheered up a little under the food.
"It isn't bad here," she said. "It isn't chic, but the food is all right."
"Better than you eat in Liège."
"Brussels, you mean."
We had another bottle of wine, and Georgette made a joke. She smiled and showed all her bad teeth, and we touched glasses.
"You're not a bad type," she said. "It's a shame you're sick. We get on well. What's the matter with you, anyway?"
"I got hurt in the war," I said.
"Oh, that dirty war."
We would probably have gone on and discussed the war and agreed that it was in reality a calamity for civilization and perhaps would have been better avoided. I was bored enough. Just then from the other room someone called,
"Barnes! I say! Barnes! Jacob Barnes!"
"It's a friend calling me," I explained and went out. There was Braddox at a big table with a party. Cohn, Francis Klein, Mrs. Braddox, several people I did not know.
"You're coming to the dance, aren't you?" Braddox asked.
"What dance?"
"Why, the dancings. Don't you know we've revived them?" Mrs. Braddox put in.
"You must come on, Jake. We're all going," Francis said from the end of the table. She was tall and had a smile.
"Of course he's coming," Braddox said. "Come in and have coffee with us, Barnes."
"Right."
"And bring your friend," said Mrs. Braddox, laughing.
She was a Canadian and had all their easy social graces.
"Thanks, we'll be in," I said. I went back to the small room.
"Who are your friends?" Georgette asked.
"Writers and artists."
"There are lots of those on this side of the river."
"Too many."
"I think so. Still, some of them make money."
"Oh, yes."
We finished the meal and the wine.
"Come on," I said, "we're going to have coffee with the others." Georgette opened her bag, made a few passes at her face as she looked in the little mirror, redefined her lips with the lipstick, and straightened her hat.
"Good," she said.
We went into the room full of people, and Braddox and the men at his table stood up.
"I wish to present my fiancée, Mademoiselle Georgette LeBlanc," I said. Georgette smiled that wonderful smile, and we shook hands all round.
"Are you related to Georgette LeBlanc, the singer?" Mrs. Braddox asked.
"Connais pas," Georgette answered.
"But you have the same name," Mrs. Braddox insisted cordially.
"No," said Georgette, "not at all. My name is Aubin."
"But Mr. Barnes introduced you as Mademoiselle Georgette LeBlanc.
Surely he did," insisted Mrs. Braddox, who in the excitement of talking French was liable to have no idea what she was saying.
"He's a fool," Georgette said.
"Oh, it was a joke then," Mrs. Braddox said.
"Yes," said Georgette, "to laugh at."
"Did you hear that, Henry?"
Mrs. Braddox called down the table to Braddox.
"Mr. Barnes introduced his fiancée as Mademoiselle LeBlanc, and her name is actually Aubin."
"Of course, darling. Mademoiselle Aubin. I've known her for a very long time.
Oh, Mademoiselle Aubin,
Francis Klein called, speaking French very rapidly and not seeming so proud and astonished as Mrs. Braddock's at its coming out really French.
Have you been in Paris long? Do you like it here? You love Paris, do you not?
Who's she?
Georgette turned to me.
Do I have to talk to her?
She turned to Francis, sitting smiling, her hands folded, her head poised on her long neck, her lips pursed, ready to start talking again.
No, I don't like Paris. It's expensive and dirty.
Really? I find it so extraordinarily clean, one of the cleanest cities in all Europe.
I find it dirty.
How strange! But perhaps you have not been here very long.
I've been here long enough.
But it does have nice people in it. One must grant that.
Georgette turned to me.
You have nice friends.
Francis was a little drunk and would have liked to have kept it up, but the coffee came, and Lavinia with the liqueurs, and after that we all went out and started for Braddock's dancing club. The dancing club was a bal musette in the Rue de la Montagne Sainte Genevieve. 5 nights a week the working people of the Pantheon quarter danced there. 1 night a week it was the dancing club. On Monday nights it was closed. When we arrived it was quite empty, except for a policeman sitting near the door, the wife of the proprietor back of the zinc bar, and the proprietor himself. The daughter of the house came downstairs as we went in. There were long benches and tables ran across the room, and at the far end a dancing floor.
"I wish people would come earlier,"
Braddock's said. The daughter came up and wanted to know what we would drink. The proprietor got up on a high stool beside the dancing floor and began to play the accordion. He had a string of bells around one of his ankles and beat time with his foot as he played. Everyone danced. It was hot, and we came off the floor perspiring.
"My God," Georgette said, "what a box to sweat in."
"It's hot.
Hot, my God."
"Take off your hat."
"That's a good idea."
Someone asked Georgette to dance, and I went over to the bar. It was really very hot, and the accordion music was pleasant in the hot night. I drank a beer, standing in the doorway and getting the cool breath of wind from the street. Two taxis were coming down the steep street. They both stopped in front of the bal. A crowd of young men, some in jerseys and some in their shirt sleeves, got out. I could see their hands and newly washed wavy hair in the light from the door. The policeman standing by the door looked at me and smiled. They came in. As they went in, under the light I saw white hands, wavy hair, white faces, grimacing, gesturing, talking. With them was Brett. She looked very lovely, and she was very much with them. One of them saw Georgette and said, "I do declare there is an actual harlot. I'm going to dance with her. Let you watch me." The tall, dark one called Let said, "Don't you be rash." The wavy blonde one answered, "Don't you worry, dear." And with them was Brett. I was very angry. Somehow they always made me angry. I know they are supposed to be amusing and you should be tolerant, but I wanted to swing on one, anyone, anything to shatter that superior simpering composure. Instead, I walked down the street and had a beer at the bar at the next bal. The beer was not good, and I had a worse cognac to take the taste out of my mouth. When I came back to the bal, there was a crowd on the floor, and Georgette was dancing with the tall blonde youth, who danced big hippily, carrying his head on one side, his eyes lifted as he danced. As soon as the music stopped, another one of them asked her to dance. She had been taken up by them. I knew then that they would all dance with her. They are like that. I sat down at a table. Cohn was sitting there. Francis was dancing. Mrs. Braddock's brought up somebody and introduced him as Robert Prentice. He was from New York by way of Chicago and was a rising new novelist. He had some sort of an English accent. I asked him to have a drink.
"Thanks so much," he said. "I've just had one."
"Have another."
"Thanks, I will then."
We got the daughter of the house over and each had a fine aloe.
"You're from Kansas City, they tell me," he said.
"Yes."
"Do you find Paris amusing?"
"Yes."
"Really?"
I was a little drunk. Not drunk in any positive sense, but just enough to be careless.
"For God's sake," I said, "yes. Don't you?"
"Oh, how charmingly you get angry," he said. "I wish I had that faculty."
I got up and walked over toward the dancing floor. Mrs. Braddock followed me.
"Don't be cross with Robert," she said. "He's still only a child, you know."
"I wasn't cross," I said. "I just thought perhaps I was going to throw up."
"Your fiancé is having a great success."
Mrs. Braddock looked out on the floor where Georgette was dancing in the arms of the tall, dark one called Let.
"Isn't she?" I said.
"Rather," said Mrs. Braddock.
Cone came up.
"Come on, Jake," he said. "Have a drink." We walked over to the bar.
"What's the matter with you? You seem all worked up over something."
"Nothing. This whole show makes me sick, is all." Brett came up to the bar.
"Hello, you chaps."
"Hello, Brett," I said. "Why aren't you tight?"
"Never going to get tight any more. I say, give a chap a brandy and soda."
She stood, holding the glass, and I saw Robert Cone looking at her. He looked a great deal as his compatriot must have looked when he saw the promised land. Cone, of course, was much younger, but he had that look of eager, deserving expectation. Brett was damned good-looking. She wore a slip-over jersey sweater and a tweed skirt, and her hair was brushed back like a boy's. She started all that. She was built with curves like the hull of a racing yacht, and you missed none of it with that wool jersey.
"It's a fine crowd you're with, Brett," I said.
"Aren't they lovely? And you, my dear.
Where did you get it?"
"At the Napolitain."
"And have you had a lovely evening?"
"Oh, priceless," I said.
Brett laughed.
"It's wrong of you, Jake. It's an insult to all of us. Look at Francis there and Joe." This for Cone's benefit.
"It's in restraint of trade," Brett said.
She laughed again.
"You're wonderfully sober," I said.
"Yes, aren't I? And when one's with the crowd I'm with, one can drink in such safety, too." The music started, and Robert Cone said, "Will you dance this with me, Lady Brett?"
Brett smiled at him.
"I've promised to dance this with Jacob," she laughed.
"You have a hell of a biblical name, Jake."
"How about the next?" asked Cone.
"We're going," Brett said. "We've a date up at Montmartre."
Dancing, I looked over Brett's shoulder and saw Cone standing at the bar still watching her.
"You've made a new one there," I said to her.
"Don't talk about it. Poor chap. I never knew it till just now."
"Oh, well," I said, "I suppose you like to add them up."
"Don't talk like a fool."
"You do."
"Oh, well, what if I do?"
"Nothing," I said.
"We were dancing to the accordion and someone was playing the banjo. It was hot and I felt happy. We passed close to Georgette dancing with another one of them."
"What possessed you to bring her?"
"I don't know, I just brought her."
"You're getting damned romantic."
"No, bored."
"Now?"
"No, not now."
"Let's get out of here. She's well taken care of."
"Do you want to?"
"Would I ask you if I didn't want to?"
We left the floor and I took my coat off a hanger on the wall and put it on. Brett stood by the bar. Cone was talking to her. I stopped at the bar and asked them for an envelope. The patron found one. I took a 50-franc note from my pocket and put it in the envelope, sealed it, and handed it to the patron.
"If the girl I came with asks for me, will you give her this?" I said. "If she goes out with one of those gentlemen, will you save this for me?"
"C'est entendu, monsieur," the patron said.
"You go now? So early?"
"Yes," I said.
We started out the door. Cone was still talking to Brett. She said good night and took my arm.
"Good night, Cone," I said.
Outside in the street we looked for a taxi.
"You're going to lose your 50 francs, Brett said.
"Oh, yes."
"No taxis."
"We could walk up to the Pantheon and get one."
"Come on, then we'll get a drink in the pub next door and send for one."
"You wouldn't walk across the street."
"Not if I could help it."
We went into the next bar, and I sent a waiter for a taxi.
"Well," I said, "we're out away from them."
We stood against the tall zinc bar and did not talk and looked at each other. The waiter came and said the taxi was outside. Brett pressed my hand hard. I gave the waiter a franc, and we went out.
"Where should I tell him?" I asked.
"Oh, tell him to drive around."
I told the driver to go to Parc Montsouris and got in and slammed the door. Brett was leaning back in the corner, her eyes closed. I got in and sat beside her.
The cab started with a jerk.
"Oh, darling, I've been so miserable," Brett said.
Chapter 4 The taxi went up the hill, past the lighted square, then on into the dark, still climbing, then leveled out onto a dark street behind Saint-Étienne-du-Mont, went smoothly down the asphalt, past the trees and the standing bus at the Place de la Contrescarpe, then turned onto the cobbles of the Rue Mouffetard. There were lighted bars and laid-open shops on each side of the street. We were sitting apart, and we jolted close together going down the old street. Brett's hat was off. Her head was back. I saw her face in the lights from the open shops, then it was dark, then I saw her face clearly as we came out on the Avenue des Gobelins. The street was torn up, and men were working on the car tracks by the light of acetylene flares. Brett's face was white, and the long line of her neck showed in the bright light of the flares. The street was dark again, and I kissed her. Our lips were tight together, and then she turned away and pressed against the corner of the seat, as far away as she could get. Her head was down. "Don't touch me," she said. "Please, don't touch me." "What's the matter?"
"I can't stand it."
"Oh, Brett."
"You mustn't. You must know. I can't stand it, that's all. Oh, darling, please understand."
"Don't you love me?"
"Love you? I simply turn all to jelly when you touch me."
"Isn't there anything we can do about it?" She was sitting up now. My arm was around her, and she was leaning back against me, and we were quite calm. She was looking into my eyes with that way she had of looking that made you wonder whether she really saw out of her own eyes. They would look on and on after everyone else's eyes in the world would have stopped looking. She looked as though there were nothing on earth she would not look at like that, and really she was afraid of so many things. "And there's not a damn thing we could do," I said.
"I don't know," she said. "I don't want to go through that hell again."
"We'd better keep away from each other."
"But, darling, I have to see you. It isn't all that, you know."
"No, but it always gets to be."
"That's my fault. Don't we pay for all the things we do, though?"
She had been looking into my eyes all the time. Her eyes had different depths. Sometimes they seemed perfectly flat. Now you could see all the way into them.
"When I think of the hell I've put chaps through, I'm paying for it all now."
"Don't talk like a fool," I said. "Besides, what happened to me is supposed to be funny. I never think about it."
"Oh, no, I'll lay you don't."
"Well, let's shut up about it."
"I laughed about it, too, myself, once."
She wasn't looking at me.
"A friend of my brother's came home that way from Mont. It seemed like a hell of a joke. Chaps never know anything, do they?"
"No," I said. "Nobody ever knows anything." I was pretty well through with the subject. At one time or another, I had probably considered it from most of its various angles, including the one that certain injuries or imperfections are a subject of merriment while remaining quite serious for the person possessing them. "It's funny," I said. "It's very funny. And it's a lot of fun, too, to be in love."
"Do you think so?"
Her eyes looked flat again. "I don't mean fun that way. In a way, it's an enjoyable feeling."
"No," she said. "I think it's hell on earth."
"It's good to see each other."
"No, I don't think it is."
"Don't you want to?"
"I have to."
We were sitting now like two strangers. On the right was the Parc Montsouris. The restaurant where they have the pool of live trout and where you can sit and look out over the park was closed and dark. The driver leaned his head around.
"Where do you want to go?" I asked.
Brett turned her head away.
"Oh, go to the Select."
"Café Select," I told the driver. "Boulevard Montparnasse." We drove straight down, turning around the Lion de Belfort that guards the passing Montrouge trams. Brett looked straight ahead. On the Boulevard Raspail, with the lights of Montparnasse in sight, Brett said,
"Would you mind very much if I ask you to do something?"
"Don't be silly."
"Kiss me just once more before we get there."
When the taxi stopped, I got out and paid. Brett came out putting on her hat. She gave me her hand as she stepped down. Her hand was shaky.
"I say, do I look too much of a mess?"
She pulled her man's felt hat down and started in for the bar. Inside, against the bar and at tables, were most of the crowd who had been at the dance.
"Hello, you chaps," Brett said. "I'm going to have a drink." Oh, Brett!
The little Greek portrait painter, who called himself a duke and whom everybody called Zizi, pushed up to her.
I got something fine to tell you.
Hello, Zizi, Brett said.
I want you to meet a friend, Zizi said.
A fat man came up.
Count Mipipopoulos, meet my friend, Lady Ashley.
How do you do? Said Brett.
Well, does your ladyship have a good time here in Paris?
Asked Count Mipipopoulos, who wore an elk's tooth on his watch chain.
Rather, said Brett.
Paris is a fine town, all right, said the Count. But I guess you have pretty big doings yourself over in London.
Oh, yes, said Brett, enormous.
Radix called to me from a table.
Barnes, he said, have a drink. That girl of yours got in a frightful row.
What about?
Something the patron's daughter said, a corking row. She was rather splendid, you know. Showed her yellow card and demanded the patron's daughters, too. I say, it was a row.
What finally happened?
Oh, someone took her home. Not a bad-looking girl. Wonderful command of the idiom. Do stay and have a drink.
No, I said, I must shove off. Seen Cone?
He went home with Francis, Mrs. Braddock put in.
Poor chap, he looks awfully down, Braddock said.
I dare say he is, said Mrs. Braddock.
I have to shove off, I said. Good night. I said good night to Brett at the bar. The Count was buying champagne.
Will you take a glass of wine with us, sir?
He asked. No, thanks awfully. I have to go.
Really going? Brett asked.
Yes, I said. I have a rotten headache.
I'll see you tomorrow.
Come in at the office.
Hardly.
Well, where will I see you?
Anywhere, around 5 o'clock.
Make it the other side of town, then.
Good. I'll be at the Crillon at 5.
Try and be there, I said.
Don't worry, Brett said.
I've never let you down, have I?
Heard from Mike.
Letter today.
Good night, sir, said the Count.
I went out onto the sidewalk and walked down toward the Boulevard Saint-Michel, past the tables of the Rotonde, still crowded, looked across the street at the Dôme, its tables running out to the edge of the pavement. Someone waved at me from a table. I did not see who it was and went on. I wanted to get home. The Boulevard Montparnasse was deserted. Lavinia's was closed tight, and they were stacking the tables outside the Closerie des Lilas. I passed Ney's statue standing among the new-leaved chestnut trees in the arc light. There was a faded purple wreath leaning against the base. I stopped and read the inscription from the Bonapartist groups, some date, I forget. He looked very fine, Marshal Ney, in his top boots, gesturing with his sword among the green new horse-chestnut leaves. My flat was just across the street, a little way down the Boulevard Saint-Michel. There was a light in the concierge's room, and I knocked on the door and she gave me my mail. I wished her good night and went upstairs. There were two letters and some papers. I looked at them under the gaslight in the dining room. The letters were from the States. One was a bank statement. It showed a balance of $2,432.60. I got out my checkbook and deducted 4 checks drawn since the first of the month and discovered I had a balance of $1,832.60. I wrote this on the back of the statement. The other letter was a wedding announcement. Mr. and Mrs. Aloysius Kirby announced the marriage of their daughter Catherine. I knew neither the girl nor the man she was marrying. They must be circularizing the town. It was a funny name. I felt sure I could remember anybody with a name like Aloysius. It was a good Catholic name. There was a crest on the announcement, like Zizi the Greek Duke. And that Count. The Count was funny. Brett had a title too, Lady Ashley. To hell with Brett. To hell with you, Lady Ashley. I lit the lamp beside the bed, turned off the gas, and opened the wide windows. The bed was far back from the windows, and I sat with the windows open and undressed by the bed. Outside, a night train, running on the streetcar tracks, went by carrying vegetables to the markets. They were noisy at night when you could not sleep. Undressing, I looked at myself in the mirror of the big armoire beside the bed. That was a typically French way to furnish a room. Practical, too, I suppose. Of all the ways to be wounded. I suppose it was funny. I put on my pajamas and got into bed. I had the two bullfight papers and I took their wrappers off.
One was orange, the other yellow. They would both have the same news, so whichever I read first would spoil the other. Le Toril was the better paper, so I started to read it. I read it all the way through, including the Petite Correspondance and the Cornograms. I blew out the lamp. Perhaps I would be able to sleep. My head started to work. The old grievance. Well, it was a rotten way to be wounded and flying on a joke front like the Italian. In the Italian hospital, we were going to form a society. It had a funny name in Italian. I wonder what became of the others, the Italians. That was in the Ospedale Maggiore in Milano, Padiglione Ponte. The next building was the Padiglione Zonda. There was a statue of Ponte, or maybe it was Zonda. That was where the liaison colonel came to visit me. That was funny. That was about the first funny thing. I was all bandaged up. But they had told him about it. Then he made that wonderful speech. You, a foreigner, an Englishman, any foreigner was an Englishman, have given more than your life. What a speech. I would like to have it illuminated to hang in the office. He never laughed. He was putting himself in my place, I guess. Che mala fortuna! Che mala fortuna! I never used to realize it, I guess. I try and play it along and just not make trouble for people. Probably I never would have had any trouble if I hadn't run into Brett when they shipped me to England. I suppose she only wanted what she couldn't have. Well, people were that way. To hell with people. The Catholic Church had an awfully good way of handling all that. Good advice, anyway. Not to think about it. Oh, it was swell advice. Try and take it sometime. Try and take it. I lay awake thinking and my mind jumping around. Then I couldn't keep away from it, and I started to think about Brett, and all the rest of it went away. I was thinking about Brett, and my mind stopped jumping around and started to go in sort of smooth waves. Then all of a sudden I started to cry. Then after a while it was better, and I lay in bed and listened to the heavy trams go by and way down the street, and then I went to sleep. I woke up. There was a row going on outside. I listened, and I thought I recognized a voice. I put on a dressing gown and went to the door. The concierge was talking downstairs. She was very angry. I heard my name and called down the stairs. Is that you, Monsieur Barnes? The concierge called. Yes, it's me. There's a species of woman here who's waked the whole street up. What kind of a dirty business at this time of night? She says she must see you. I've told her you're asleep. Then I heard Brett's voice. Half asleep, I had been sure it was Georgette. I don't know why. She could not have known my address. Will you send her up, please? Brett came up the stairs. I saw she was quite drunk. Silly thing to do, she said. Make an awful row. I say, you weren't asleep, were you? What did you think I was doing? Don't know. Oh, what time is it? I looked at the clock. It was 4:30. Had no idea what hour it was, Brett said. I say, can a chap sit down? Don't be cross, darling. Just left the count. He brought me here. What's he like? I was getting brandy and soda and glasses. Just a little, said Brett. Don't try and make me drunk. The count? Oh, rather, he's quite one of us. Is he a count? Here's how. I rather think so, you know. Deserves to be, anyway. Knows hell's own amount about people. Don't know where he got it all. Owns a chain of sweet shops in the States. She sipped at her glass. Think he called it a chain. Something like that. Linked them all up. Told me a little about it. Damned interesting. He's one of us, though. Oh, quite. No doubt. One can always tell. She took another drink. How do I buck on about all this? You don't mind, do you? He's putting up for Zizi, you know. Is Zizi really a duke, too? I shouldn't wonder. Greek, you know. Rotten painter. I rather like the Count. Where did you go with him? Oh, everywhere. He just brought me here now. Offered me $10,000 to go to Biarritz with him. How much is that in pounds?
Around 2,000.
Lot of money. I told him I couldn't do it. He was awfully nice about it. Told him I knew too many people in Biarritz. Brett laughed. I say, you are slow on the uptake, she said. I'd only sipped my brandy and soda. I took a long drink. That's better. Very funny, Brett said. Then he wanted me to go to Cannes with him. Told him I knew too many people in Cannes. Monte Carlo. Told him I knew too many people in Monte Carlo. Told him I knew too many people everywhere. Quite true, too. So I asked him to bring me here. She looked at me, her hand on the table, her glass raised. Don't look like that, she said. Told him I was in love with you. True, too. Don't look like that. He was damn nice about it. Wants to drive us out to dinner tomorrow night. Like to go? Why not? I'd better go now. Why? Just wanted to see you. Damn silly idea. Want to get dressed and come down? He's got the car just up the street. The Count? Himself. And a chauffeur in livery. Going to drive me around and have breakfast in the Bois. Hampers. Got it all at Zelly's. Dozen bottles of Mums. Tempt you? I have to work in the morning, I said. I'm too far behind you now to catch up and be any fun. Don't be an ass. Can't do it. Right. Send him a tender message. Anything. Absolutely. Good night, darling. Don't be sentimental. You make me ill. We kissed goodnight and Brett shivered. I'd better go, she said. Good night, darling. You don't have to go. Yes. We kissed again on the stairs, and as I called for the cordon, the concierge muttered something behind her door. I went back upstairs and from the open window watched Brett walking up the street to the big limousine drawn up to the curb under the arc light. She got in and it started off. I turned around. On the table was an empty glass and a glass half full of brandy and soda. I took them both out to the kitchen and poured the half full glass down the sink. I turned off the gas in the dining room, kicked off my slippers, sitting on the bed, and got into bed. This was Brett that I had felt like crying about. Then I thought of her walking up the street and stepping into the car as I had last seen her. And of course in a little while I felt like hell again. It's awfully easy to be hard-boiled about everything in the daytime, but at night it is another thing. Chapter 5. In the morning I walked down the boulevard to the Rue Soufflot for coffee and brioche. It was a fine morning. The horse chestnut trees in the Luxembourg Gardens were in bloom. There was the pleasant early morning feeling of a hot day. I read the papers with the coffee and then smoked a cigarette. The flower women were coming up from the market and arranging their daily stock. Students went by going up to the law school or down to the Sorbonne. The boulevard was busy with trams and people going to work. I got on an S-bus and rode down to the Madeleine, standing on the back platform. From the Madeleine, I walked along the Boulevard des Capucines to the Opéra and up to my office. I passed the man with the jumping frogs and the man with the boxer toys. I stepped aside to avoid walking into the thread with which his girl assistant manipulated the boxers. She was standing looking away, the thread in her folded hands. The man was urging two tourists to buy. Three more tourists had stopped and were watching. I walked on behind a man who was pushing a roller that printed the name Cinzano on the sidewalk in damp letters. All along, people were going to work. It felt pleasant to be going to work. I walked across the avenue and turned into my office. Upstairs in the office, I read the French morning papers, smoked, and then sat at the typewriter and got off a good morning's work. At 11 o'clock, I went over to the Quai d'Orsay in a taxi and went in and sat with about a dozen correspondents, while the Foreign Office mouthpiece, a young Nouvelle Revue Française diplomat in horn-rimmed spectacles, talked and answered questions for half an hour. The president of the council was in Lyon making a speech, or rather he was on his way back. Several people asked questions to hear themselves talk, and there were a couple of questions asked by news servicemen who wanted to know the answers. There was no news. I shared a taxi back from the Quai d'Orsay with Woolsey and Crum. "What do you do nights, Jake?" asked Crum. "I never see you around." "Oh, I'm over in the quarter." "I'm coming over some night. The Dingo, that's the great place, isn't it?" "Yes, that or this new dive, the Select." "I've meant to get over," said Crum. "You know how it is, though, with a wife and kids."
"Playing any tennis?" Woolsey asked.
"Well, no," said Crum. "I can't say I played any this year. I've tried to get away, but Sundays it's always rained, and the courts are so damned crowded."
"The Englishmen have all Saturday off," Woolsey said.
Lucky beggars, said Crumb. Well, I'll tell you, someday I'm not going to be working for an agency. Then I'll have plenty of time to get out in the country.
That's the thing to do, live out in the country and have a little car.
I've been thinking some about getting a car next year.
I banged on the glass. The chauffeur stopped. Here's my street, I said. Come in and have a drink.
Thanks, old man, Crumb said.
Woolsey shook his head. I've got to file that line he got off this morning.
I put a 2-franc piece in Crumb's hand.
You're crazy, Jake, he said. This is on me.
It's all on the office, anyway.
Nope, I want to get it.
I waved goodbye. Crumb put his head out.
See you at the lunch on Wednesday.
You bet.
I went to the office in the elevator. Robert Cohn was waiting for me.
Hello, Jake, he said. Going out to lunch?
Yes, let me see if there's anything new.
Where will we eat?
Anywhere.
I was looking over my desk.
Where do you want to eat?
How about Wetzel's? They've got good hors d'oeuvres.
In the restaurant, we ordered hors d'oeuvres and beer. The sommelier brought the beer, tall, beaded on the outside of the steins, and cold. There were a dozen different dishes of hors d'oeuvres.
Have any fun last night? I asked.
No, I don't think so.
How's the writing going?
Rotten. I can't get the second book going.
Well, that happens to everybody.
Oh, I'm sure of that. It gets me worried, though.
Thought any more about going to South America?
I mean that.
Well, why don't you start off?
Francis.
Well, I said, take her with you.
Oh, she wouldn't like it. That isn't the sort of thing she likes. She likes a lot of people around.
Well, tell her to go to hell.
I can't. I've got certain obligations to her.
He shoved the sliced cucumbers away and took a pickled herring.
What do you know about Lady Brett Ashley, Jake?
Her name's Lady Ashley. Brett's her own name. She's a nice girl, I said. She's getting a divorce and she's going to marry Mike Campbell. He's over in Scotland now.
Why?
She's a remarkably attractive woman,
isn't she?
There's a certain quality about her, a certain fineness. She seems to be absolutely fine and straight.
Well, she's very nice.
I don't know how to describe the quality, Cohn said. I suppose it's breeding.
You sound as though you liked her pretty well.
I do. I shouldn't wonder if I were in love with her.
She's a drunk, I said. She's in love with Mike Campbell, and she's going to marry him. He's going to be rich as hell someday.
I don't believe she'll ever marry him.
Why not?
I don't know. I just don't believe it.
Have you known her a long time?
Yes, I said. She was a VAD in a hospital I was in during the war.
Well, she must have been just a kid then.
She's 34 now.
When did she marry Ashley?
During the war. Her own true love had just kicked off with the dysentery.
You talk sort of bitter.
Sorry, I didn't mean to. I was just trying to give you the facts.
I don't believe she would marry anybody she didn't love.
Well, I said, she's done it twice.
I don't believe it.
Well, I said, don't ask me a lot of fool questions if you don't like the answers.
I didn't ask you that.
You asked me what I knew about Brett Ashley.
I didn't ask you to insult her.
Oh, go to hell.
He stood up from the table, his face white, and stood there white and angry behind the little plates of hors d'oeuvres.
Sit down, I said. Don't be a fool.
You've got to take that back.
Oh, cut out the prep school stuff.
Take it back.
Sure, anything. I never heard of Brett Ashley. How's that?
No, not that. About me going to hell.
Oh, don't go to hell. I said, stick around. We're just starting lunch.
Cohn smiled again and sat down. He seemed glad to sit down. What the hell would he have done if he hadn't sat down?
You say such damned insulting things, Jake.
I'm sorry. I've got a nasty tongue. I never mean it when I say nasty things.
I know it, Cohn said. You're really about the best friend I have, Jake.
God help you, I thought.
Forget what I said out loud. I'm sorry.
It's all right. It's fine. I was just sore for a minute.
Good. Let's get something else to eat.
After we finished the lunch, we walked up to the Café de la Paix and had coffee. I could feel Cohn wanted to bring up Brett again, but I held him off it. We talked about one thing and another, and I left him to come to the office.
Chapter 6
At 5 o'clock, I was in the Hotel Crillon waiting for Brett. She was not there, so I sat down and wrote some letters. They were not very good letters, but I hoped their being on Crillon stationery would help them. Brett did not turn up, so about 5:45, I went down to the bar and had a Jack Rose with George the barman.
Brett had not been in the bar either, and so I looked for her upstairs on my way out and took a taxi to the Café Select. Crossing the Seine, I saw a string of barges being towed empty down the current, riding high, the bargemen at the sweeps as they came toward the bridge. The river looked nice. It was always pleasant crossing bridges in Paris. The taxi rounded the statue of the inventor of the semaphore, engaged in doing same, and turned up the Boulevard Raspail, and I sat back to let that part of the ride pass. The Boulevard Raspail always made dull riding. It was like a certain stretch on the PLM between Fontainebleau and Montereau that always made me feel bored and dead and dull until it was over. I suppose it is some association of ideas that makes those dead places in a journey. There are other streets in Paris as ugly as the Boulevard Raspail. It's a street I do not mind walking down at all, but I cannot stand to ride along it. Perhaps I had read something about it once. That was the way Robert Cohn was about all of Paris. I wondered where Cohn got that incapacity to enjoy Paris. Possibly from Mencken. Mencken hates Paris, I believe. So many young men get their likes and dislikes from Mencken. The taxi stopped in front of the Rotonde. No matter what café in Montparnasse you ask a taxi driver to bring you to from the right bank of the river, they always take you to the Rotonde. 10 years from now, it will probably be the Dôme. It was near enough, anyway. I walked past the sad tables of the Rotonde to the Select. There were a few people inside at the bar, and outside, alone, sat Harvey Stone. He had a pile of saucers in front of him, and he needed a shave. "Sit down," said Harvey. "I've been looking for you." "What's the matter?" "Nothing. Just looking for you." "Been out to the races?" "No, not since Sunday." "What do you hear from the States?" "Nothing. Absolutely nothing." "What's the matter?" "I don't know. I'm through with them. I'm absolutely through with them." He leaned forward and looked me in the eye. "You want to know something, Jake?"
"Yes?"
"I haven't had anything to eat for 5 days." I figured rapidly back in my mind. It was 3 days ago that Harvey had won 200 francs from me shaking poker dice in the New York bar.
"What's the matter?"
"No money. Money hasn't come." He paused. "I tell you, it's strange, Jake. When I'm like this, I just want to be alone. I want to stay in my own room. I'm like a cat." I felt in my pocket.
"Would 100 help you any, Harvey?"
"Yes."
"Come on, let's go and eat."
"There's no hurry. Have a drink."
"Better eat."
"No, when I get like this, I don't care whether I eat or not."
We had a drink. Harvey added my saucer to his own pile.
"Do you know Mencken, Harvey?"
"Yes, why?"
"What's he like?"
"He's all right. He says some pretty funny things. Last time I had dinner with him, we talked about Hoffenheimer."
"The trouble is," he said, "he's a garter snapper."
"That's not bad."
"Well, that's not bad."
"He's through now," Harvey went on. "He's written about all the things he knows, and now he's on all the things he doesn't know."
"I guess he's all right," I said. "I just can't read him."
"Oh, nobody reads him now," Harvey said, "except the people that used to read the Alexander Hamilton Institute."
"Well," I said, "that was a good thing, too."
"Sure," said Harvey.
So we sat and thought deeply for a while.
"Have another port?"
"All right," said Harvey.
"There comes Cohn," I said. Robert Cohn was crossing the street.
"That moron," said Harvey.
Cohn came up to our table.
"Hello, you bums," he said.
"Hello, Robert," Harvey said.
"I was just telling Jake here that you're a moron."
"What do you mean?"
"Tell us right off, and don't think. What would you rather do if you could do anything you wanted?"
This book is continued on Disc 2.